to talk about a very terrible situation because I believe we can do something about it. For too long, Christians have thought nothing can be done about the downward slide of our society, the downward slide of our universities in particular. We send our kids off. In fact, my guest today, I heard him saying in another interview with Frank Turek, he was saying, we're literally paying for the apostasy of our own children. That's true. That's all very true. But for too long, we have just sort of shrugged our shoulders and thought, a lot of us have just thought, I guess there's nothing that can be done. That can change. All we have to do is believe that it can change. And then we realize we have incredible power to change our culture, change our universities, and all of that stuff. And I think that that's thinking biblically, right? The disciples was this tiny little group of guys that went out there, like with this idea that they were going to transform the entire world for Jesus. They really just believed that. And it gave them the courage to move forward and try it. And so I think we need to believe that in all areas of our lives. So here is my guest, Dr. Corey Miller, and he's working with, well, he's the president of Ratio Christi, and also he is working hard to try to help transform and change the universities, to take them back, because they used to actually be on our side. And they desperately need to be on our side because the kids go to the schools teach them their ideologies, and then those people end up running the world, right? In Hollywood, in government, in companies. And so we will get to the root of the problem if we can get to school. So, Dr. Corey Miller, thanks for joining me.
It is so good to be here with you. I'm looking forward to this.
Yeah, me too. Me too. Okay, I want to talk about the problem and then we'll talk about the solution. It's going to be in here. We will talk about the solution. So, know that we're addressing the problem because of what we can do about it. So, what is the problem in your mind that we're talking about?
Well, as people hear, what happens in Vegas stays in Vegas. What happens in the university does not stay in the university. It was never intended to. As go the universities, so goes the culture. As goes the US university, so goes the world.
I believe that 100%. I've actually seen it happen in my life. We were talking before the stream about I was 14 years as a youth pastor, and I watched how the students would go to universities and the things that they would learn there would have a huge impact in their lives on a very practical one-on-one level. Even my own time briefly in college was I was exposed to this transition moment where the college was moving towards like a progressive view. And I remember a teacher I had, a college professor I had, who was teaching Western history, Western Civ. And there was these chants back from the 60s, 70s, you know, hey ho, Western Civ has got to go. And he talked about this. Now, he was a conservative, but he kept it very secret. But he was teaching this Western Civ class. And as soon as he retired, they were going to cancel the class. It was no longer going to be taught at Cerritos College. That was what he told me. And I was there his last year and actually watched the class die. The Western civilization class died because they thought that it was oppressive effectively. So this stuff, though, affects our Christian worldview. It affects believers. We watch them go to college. And how about you walk me through this? What happens when a student goes to college or goes to university? What happens to their worldview, their ideology?
Well, my own experience is similar to yours in that I was a youth pastor at one time. I began as a seventh generation Mormon in Salt Lake City, Utah, but by God's grace, I was saved out of that. And that gave me a passion for truth, though, and that's where the field of apologetics came up. I ended up going off to Bible college and to seminary, and I became a youth pastor. But at a certain juncture, I just got so sick of seeing my students go off to what I call the secular baptismal font and lose their faith. They would come back for Christmas break. I would try to put their brains back in. They would leave again, come back, and now they just wouldn't come back at all. And so I had a desire for evangelism after coming out of Mormonism, but God had given me a strategic mind as well. And so I envisioned this whole situation like the Greeks and the Trojan horse. They tried to breach the walls of Troy for a decade, always failing. And so they figured out the stealth plan to get in from the inside out. And so my thought was, if I can go off to a good secular university and get a PhD in a field where I could talk openly about truth, beauty, goodness, then I could maybe defend some of our own and advance the cause of Christ there. And I never realized how hostile it was until I got to the PhD level, where, right off the bat, 6 weeks into it, I'm getting prank calls at 3 o'clock in the morning from my colleagues mocking me for my faith. My second semester, I have a Marxist professor put a permanent note in my file that I'm delusional and schizophrenic. And then by the end of my 5th year, when I was all but dissertation, I had my PhD sabotaged and told I had too much of a faith perspective. So I actually had to go on for a second time. And during that time, the second time through, I am teaching as a ethics professor at Indiana University, and I had a former pastor who turned gay charge me with creating a suicidal environment simply because I was talking about both sides of the issue on human sexuality, and I don't think that was what he was accustomed to, because most aren't. Everyone, you know, takes a particular venue, a vista of this whole thing, hate or celebrate, and we all want to celebrate, of course, so that's what you do. And, you know, when I realized how bad this was and how top-heavy it was with Christian, with non-Christian professors, the numbers are extraordinarily lopsided. This is not a place of viewpoint diversity in the least bit. That gave me a passion also at that time to go after professors, to reach out to professors. And so I had joined a campus ministry that did just that and, you know, finally acquired my PhD the second time around and got a call from a ministry called Ratio Christi that focuses on apologetics evangelism at the undergrad level, but integration and infiltration at the graduate and professor level. And so I jumped in. And Mike, since I've been here in the last decade, we've had, I don't know, probably 160 cases of legal proceedings, 4 federal victories, 5 appellate court victories, 2 SCOTUS assists. And as Joe Biden was going out the door, we gave him a victory lap with the Department of Education. So,
and we may get into more of those details.
Yeah,
specifically, because that'll be when we talk about maybe strategies for how we can change things.
Right.
But what you're describing right now, when you describe, Corey, the hostility there is to the Christian worldview, it's not just I disagree with you. When we say hostility, we don't mean you're the only believer in that room. That's not hostility. You're just outnumbered, but it's not hostile. What's hostile is trying to sabotage your education, trying to sabotage your dissertation. I've known believers who it's routinely understood that in many PhD programs and universities, you hide the fact that you're a Christian until after you get your PhD. This is like routinely. Now, you don't have to hide the fact that you're a Marxist. You don't have to hide the fact that you're an atheist. But you do have to hide that you're a Christian, because here's the thing that I want us to grab onto. The liberals or the left, right, they have more readily understood that they have the ability to control the country by controlling the universities. And that's why they fight so hard on that high level ground, because they know that this is the lever that pulls the whole nation. So what we need to do as Christians is just match that energy, I think, when it comes to trying to get into and have influence inside the universities and have long-term plans. But okay, before we get into those plans, I wonder if you can help the viewer who might be watching going, you know, I've heard there's like liberal universities and all this, but help them understand this, if you don't mind, by walking through, if you could, hypothetically pretend that you're describing here a typical Christian, maybe nominal type Christian, who goes through youth ministry, who goes to church their whole lives, and then they graduate high school and they go off to university. What is their experience like in relation to their Christian faith?
Well, I think there are 2 things that happen. You're attending the university and Friday night comes around and you've got frat row on the one hand. And so you've got temptation. You're away from your youth group. You're away from your Christian friends, from your parents and so forth. And you've got these temptations. Everybody's starting to do it. And you are holding back, though. But Monday through Friday, during the day, you're going through all the classes. And you get Nietzsche in philosophy. You get Freud in psychology. You get Darwin in science. You get just anything and everything that is secular and subversive to your Christian faith. And by the time the next Friday rolls around, you're thinking, why am I holding back? Why am I not having fun like everybody else is doing now? Because this stuff is incredible. I learned on one knee growing up that Santa exists and the other knee that God exists. And I figured the first one out on my own. I was pretty smart. But I had to wait until I got to the PhDs, to the professors. And when they are almost consensus-driven, anti-Christian in their perspectives, not always as much in their attitudes, it depends on the professor, but in their perspectives, it is so heavily dominated that I come home for Christmas on the first Christmas break, and I say, Mom, Dad, I love you guys. Christmas will never be the same.
This is going on. It has been going on for a long, long time. And we can change it. I believe we can change it. But people have to understand that it's not just that your kids go to college and they get into a bad peer environment. That can also be true. That's a big influence. But it's also that they go there and they get ideological training that is antithetical to the Christian worldview. That's the part that I think, like you said, it opens the door to them then saying, I guess I'll just join my peers in all the things that they're doing. Because what's the point of denying myself, taking up my cross and following Jesus if, like, maybe Jesus didn't even exist, or maybe, like, why would I trust the Bible? Or even if God is real, I don't like him anymore. And that's actually one of the biggest battlegrounds is not just whether Christianity is true, but whether you should like it or not. That's right. One of the current battlegrounds.
Even if, people think about the issue of eternal security, once saved, always saved, it really doesn't matter what your view is on that issue when it comes down to the practical consequences of what happens at the university, mm-hmm. because belief is a degreed property. If I believe something, I believe it, 51 to 99%. I lack certainty perhaps at 100%, but 51 to 99%. Well, I'm not going to act on my beliefs at 51%, hardly. I'm still sort of a straddler on the fence. If I'm at 70%, I will. If at 90%, I'm just gung-ho. So what happens to real believers, even if they don't technically lose their faith, they may as well, practically speaking, because they get so beaten down at the university intellectually that the heart cannot embrace what the mind cannot believe. And if I'm just on the fence, almost paying for fire insurance here, thinking I'll just hedge my bet just in case, and I'll continue to believe in God, but I'm not really sure anymore, that rocks one's world, and it has practical consequences. As Richard Weaver once said, ideas have consequences, and what we want to add to that is bad ones make victims, and good ones transform lives, societies, and civilizations. And moreover, we talk a lot about politics, but that's downstream. We pour a ton of money into politics, but all that is pouring chlorine downstream, and you can see, finally the bottom of the pond, maybe for 15 seconds. But it's what's upstream that's the problem. And since politics is downstream from culture, culture from education, and at the apex of education is the university, unless we change the university, we're going to continually having problems down in the culture, and that includes into the church culture.
Right. So I had a former student who, she went on to be a nurse. And in nursing school, she was taught gender ideology. And it was in the form of, when you get a patient who, this was before it really blew up, right? This was years before it really blew up in recent time. And she was taught, if you get someone who says, like, I'm actually a woman, but it's a man, you're supposed to always refer to that person as she and talk to them as though they're female, even though they're a man. And she was wrestling with this a little bit because she didn't quite see it clearly, but she could feel there was something about this that somehow maybe conflicted with her Christian worldview. But it wasn't clear to her, right? It was just, she wasn't sure. She felt it. So we discussed it, and her response when I was like, the problem with this is that you're affirming a delusion, and it's a harmful delusion, and, love rejoices in the truth, not lies. And so here's a Christian ideological viewpoint that conflicts with gender ideology. And her response was what her teachers told her. Well, it's true for them. It's their truth.
Yeah.
And so now me, I realize there's two different things going on here at one moment. And because of her nursing education, which you'd be like, you're learning medicine. Why would you get your Christian ideology challenged? You're learning medicine. This is irrelevant. But it's not. This is what they do. They infuse ideology everywhere. So because of this ideological question, she has one issue, a disconnected Christian worldview from the topic of gender ideology. But she has a second issue, which is a much bigger problem, which is truth itself is being threatened.
Right.
The belief in truth and even knowing what truth means, what it is, and that objective truth is there, is being threatened. And the thing is, this doesn't directly touch the gospel. But once it's seeded in the heart of a person that that's your truth, now the gospel is meaningless. It does affect the gospel. It's just not directly about the gospel. And so these worldview issues really matter. So we need Christians in college, in university, students to be sitting in class. And when they go, well, that's their truth, they immediately go, oh, that's a gender ideology problem. That's also a major worldview issue. And it totally disenfranchises the gospel itself. It's also self-contradictory. They have to be able to just, all this stuff has to be in their minds right away.
Right.
And I think that this comes down to, we could bring this up, I guess, now, the controlled speech that there is in these environments.
Huh.
Universities, when you teach gender ideology and when you teach uncritical DEI stuff, to be honest, which ends up being, I think, against the Christian worldview. When you teach these things, they can't really stand up very well in a debate environment.
Mm-hmm.
And so you must control speech. So you got to shut down freedom of speech and freedom of thought. So maybe you could talk about that. Like, what is the current state of our universities? Didn't they used to be places where free discussion and debating ideas was considered like a center point of the university experience?
Yeah, I mean, if I can give you the statistics that came out, this was a couple of years ago in a Yale National Student Survey, to give you an idea where we're at. 48% support campus speech codes. Now, we've won a federal victory on this, but it happens all the time still. 48% support campus speech codes.
What is a campus speech code?
Thou shalt not. So you have an entire lexicon of words that thou shalt not say. And you can think of and use your wildest imagination when it comes to critical race theory, critical queer theory, critical gender theory, anything that may hurt a person. So that gets to that next point, and that is 81% believe that speech is a form of violence. Maybe not physical violence, but psychological violence. And people commit suicide over psychological violence. So 33% say that physical violence is justified in order to prevent hate speech. And then when you figure out, well, what is the meaning of hate speech? 66% say that it's anything a student believes to be considered hurtful to a particular person. So when Charlie Kirk got assassinated, he had to go because he was erasing people's existence. He was harming them psychologically. They were already predisposed, according to what people say in the LGBT community, to suicidality. Now he probably just pushes them over. So he had to go. He had to take one for the team. The greater good for the greater number of people.
This is shocking, and it should freak everybody out, to the idea that your speech is violence, and therefore I can be violent in response to your speech.
Right.
That is it. For me, the light bulb moment was years and years ago when I heard people debating, is it okay to punch Nazis?
Yeah.
Because I already knew that they were calling me a Nazi even at the time. And so what I'm really hearing is they're debating if it's okay for them to just punch me randomly because they're convinced that I'm a Nazi, right? And it's just a name-calling coupled with a violence ideology. And we do see the violence. What percentage of it, of college students, think it's okay to commit violence against people who use speech you don't like?
33. So 1 in 3 college students. And that was a couple of years ago. I'm sure the number has ticked up since then. And so that's why even the professors now are scared of what's happening because of the students that are coming in. But the professors are the ones that created that environment in the first place. And as I tell people, and I lay out in my book, The Progressive Miseducation of America, is that we are in a revolution today. This is a cultural revolution for sure. But it comes from predominant ideological revolutions that emerged from the universities. In two phases, you know, we started the universities where the whole point was the pursuit of truth. Harvard, 1636, 6 years after the Puritans landed, filled their guts full of turkey. Then they went off and started Harvard, right, where the vast majority of people attending Harvard were attending to go be missionaries and ministers, essentially. And that lasted up until about 1840, where virtually every college in the country, the president was also a member of the clergy, and he would give the capstone lecture, a course on moral philosophy, giving the commencement address and sending them out to the world to be good citizens. By 1880, church and chapel attendance were still required, but that's when the battle began for 50 years, and we didn't have any PhD programs here in America, so we sent them all over to Europe, and mostly to Germany. And at Germany at the time, that's where you're coming off the heels of the most formally educated country in the history of the world. And you have Immanuel Kant. We remember him by "You Kant No Ultimate Reality," the ending of the Enlightenment. It was a failure. You get Schleiermacher, the father of modern liberal theology.
Yuck.
you get Spinoza. You get Freudian sexuality, Nietzsche and philosophy, Marx and Engels. And so all the graduates would come back to, you know, Harvard, Princeton, and Yale that we all started, and they took them over. So we had to start phase two of Calvin and Wheaton and Biola. And right when the dust was settling in the 1930s and scientific naturalism had taken over and would reign for about the better part of a century, and it impacted the church by giving us liberal Protestant theology and the social gospel, the second revolution was about to begin. In the 1930s, this little mustache guy emerged to power called Adolf Hitler. And at the time, you had the neo-Marxist over there, which was Freud plus Marx. And they had to get out of town because they were globalist socialists. They hated the fascists. They were anti-fascist, Antifa. That's what it is. And they ended up, those leaders of critical theory, critical race theory, gender theory, et cetera, they came over to America into our top schools. And it took a long time, decades and decades, to embed themselves into the system. But by the time you get through it, the 60s, they looked at the 70s and thought, you know what, we really need the workers of the world to unite, are not on the factory floors anymore. We need to be going after the big prize, and that is academia, then media, then ecclesia. And so they began ensconcing themselves into the universities. When at the time, the ratio of liberal to conservative professor was just 2.3 to 1. You would die if I told you what it is today.
Well, you should tell us. What is today, what is the ratio of liberal to conservative professors?
It's 12 to 1 for those retiring. It's 23 to 1 for those that just got tenure and have about 30 years ahead of them. Mm-hmm. It's 27 to 1 for those that are Ivy League professors. And the higher you go up the scale, it's about 99% at Harvard, 98% at Princeton, 97% at Yale. And when parents hear these stats, you know, the wife usually elbows the husband and says, "We need to make sure that Johnny takes a religion class if he goes there." And that's when I say, no, I mean, it's 70 to 1 in religion. And the right. number of people that are explicitly claiming to be Marxists, in the social sciences, for example, it's about 18%. Those claiming activist, 20%. Radical, 24%. So you're talking like 60% claiming to be explicitly radical, activist, or Marxist. And that doesn't mean those that are adjacent to it that don't explicitly claim it. So this is not an institute of viewpoint diversity. If our people are not going into these institutions equipped and ready for this, it is like shooting fish in a barrel. And as you cited that at the beginning, that I like to say, parents and grandparents are literally paying for the apostasy of their own children and the future leaders and the downfall of America.
I hate to say it, but I think that that's a correct assessment. I think that's an accurate assessment of the overall trends. Now, there are always individual stories. Someone goes and they're like, "Well, I had a good experience and my faith is great. You know, then there's others who they go and their faith becomes progressive and they think that it was a positive impact on their faith. And I know people personally who they became progressive. And I think one thing for us to, in our worldview, to understand, tell me what you think of this, is the idea that the liberal or progressive theology, the progressive political stuff and the progressive education stuff, like critical race theory or Marxism or Marxism adjacent stuff, that these are all different like branches of the same tree. And that tree is ultimately in opposition to the Christian worldview. And so this is the thing that people will think, "Well, Mike, you're getting political a lot." And I will be getting more political in the future, I promise. But I want people to understand the reason is because I see the root of the tree and it's antithetical to my Christian worldview. And this is why you'll get the same person who embraces like Marxist or socialist ideologies will also be rejecting core doctrines of the Christian faith most of the time.
Right.
They come together. So like, does that make sense? Or maybe you can help explain that?
So the first ideological revolution was scientific naturalism, right? And you could see it when the department names started to change. Politics was always part of ethics for 2,500 years. But now it's called political science. And then psychology, which means psychology, the study of the soul, is no longer about the study of the soul. It's about the brain and the central nervous system, or input, output, you know, things like that. And so they changed the name to the Department of Psychological Sciences. Everybody wanted to be part of the sciences until they didn't. And that's when the scientific revolution, when that guard started to get pushed out by the new revolutionary guard coming in, who, as you cited earlier, you know, truth is reducible to power. Rorty said that truth is what my peers will let me get away with. So the first ideological revolution believed that truth was objective, that we could discover it, but only through science, right? And they believed that, like Voltaire, I may disagree with what you say, but I would defend to the death your right to say it. But those coming in now from the postmodern cultural Marxist zeitgeist or worldview, they disagree with that. And you have a statement by someone like Stalin, ideas are more powerful than weapons. We don't allow our enemies to have weapons, so why should we let them have ideas? That's the root of cancel culture right there. And it's illiberal, not liberal. And that's why the liberals, even the liberal atheists, are now getting kicked out. And they're wanting to join and become friends with, say, conservative Christians. Richard Dawkins even claims to be a cultural Christian. Elon Musk, a cultural Christian. Jordan Peterson, an existentialist Christian. And when you talked about politics, remember, politics, until that first revolution, it's part of ethics. So to say, I don't want to get political, means I don't want to get ethical, right? Politics is just ethics for the public good. And if the Christian wants to have any influence on ethics, we should be engaged in politics. It may not be the end game. What is the end game is, what is real? How do I know what is real? And then finally, how should I then live based on what I know about reality? So ethics is the third branch of philosophy. It's downstream. It's what we fight about over in election season. But the Titanic did not get sunk by ethics. It got sunk by the deeper stuff. What is real? How do I know what is real? And that first revolutionary ideology taught that anything that's not sense perceptible is not real or knowable. The next one came in and said, you know what? That's not even real or knowable. Knowledge is a social construction of reality, and that includes gender knowledge as well. I think I'm a woman, therefore I am a woman. So that's what's going on. And then if you oppose them, that is hate speech. That hates the person. And so what we're having is middle schoolers, you know, transing at greater numbers than even middle schoolers that exist. It's exaggeration, but they're coming home and they're talking to mom and dad, grandma and grandpa, and saying, mom, dad, grandma, grandpa, would you rather have a dead son or a living daughter? You choose. And so the parents or grandparents, just to hold on to a shoestring of relationship, end up going progressive themselves.
Yeah. And the culture, including schools, have given kids these ideas. They do not occur naturally for the most part. For the vast majority, this does not occur naturally. This is something that has been culturally created as a result of critical theory and things like that, that really got planted in the universities and then trickles down. And the normal people, the common people, they don't ever hear critical theory language. They don't hear that. They just hear things like, you know, you're trying to tell me that trans people don't exist.
Yeah,
that's what you're denying, the existence of trans people. That's what they hear as the slogan, the rhetoric, and then they have to sort of feel out the worldview behind it and then adopt that without even really knowing what they're adopting. But they know one thing: they know that they're really angry if you don't adopt it too. that's the one thing they know. It's a weird thing, but the connection to the universities is real. Let's talk more about, if we can, so we know the core tenets of the Christian faith, right? Jesus, God's existence, Jesus, his identity, the death and resurrection of Christ, and the way of salvation. You know, you trust in Christ for the forgiveness of your sins. You don't do anything to earn it. He does everything. You repent and believe. What are the core tenets in the university that you are worried about? What are those core beliefs?
Well, I mean, you still have I don't know if it's a majority, but scientific naturalism still tends to pervade all of the hard sciences. On that,
So let's just move forward.
Sharing live stream? Okay.
Yeah. Hey, Sarah, I'm working on it. Thanks. It's my assistant. She's just like, in case I didn't know.
Okay.
All right, we're just going to make sure that we're live. You know, Zoom, I didn't realize they were putting their watermark on our stream, but now I'm glad they are because now they can take credit for failing. All right, just a second till I know that we're actually working.
Okay.
Okay, I think we're good. I think we're good.
Okay.
Okay, hey guys. All right, so we were talking about the issue
AI.
of scientific naturalism.
Yeah. So in that part of the academy, those are the ideas, scientific naturalism, that nature is all that is, was, or ever will be. And so the way you know what is through sense perception. And then the way you go live then is based on what you know about the sense perceptible world. So all ethics has to be naturalized. But now with postmodern cultural Marxism coming in and jumping tracks, it's starting to infuse itself into math, medicine, engineering, and physics, and so forth. So you're getting taken over in this ideological revolution, even in the hard sciences. But in the social sciences and the humanities, where they believe that knowledge is just a social construction of reality, how should I then live is however you want, truth is reducible to power. So everything is about identity politics or identity power. And what you're trying to do is to simply persuade people, not about truth, because there is none. It's your truth and my truth. But it tends to be whatever the collective says it is and agrees to at this moment in time.
So you've got an issue of basically methodological naturalism is can be a useful scientific tool, but you're talking about philosophical, like an actual belief that all there is the physical world. And so this leads towards the denial of the human soul and all sorts of other things, and
Right.
it causes a bunch of other problems, but it opens the door to losing the guardrails that are there, that are in place when you believe, for instance, that that little baby is a is isn't just a physical organism that is human by definition, but it is like that's like a child made in God's image with like a human soul. There's something transcendently true about that. And then you've also got the issue of just challenging truth itself, which is really squirrely. I don't know how anybody gets away with this. Because the second you challenge truth, you inherently make a claim that is self-contradictory.
I think this is the internal contradiction we find in this new ideological revolution, too. Going back historically, just for a moment, when you had in the 1930s this school of critical theory, the Frankfurt School of Critical Theory, which were mostly Jewish leaders, but they were globalist socialists, and they had to get out of Germany. They did, and they went to America. Down south, you had Antonio Gramsci. And he was locked in prison by Mussolini. He never got out of prison. He died there. But his prison notes got translated into the English-speaking world by a Marxist professor at Notre Dame, right here in my state of Indiana, named Joseph Buttigieg, father of Mayor Pete. So what Mayor Pete grew up with was not just ordinary homosexuality, but critical queer theory. And that's what you're starting to see, infiltrating into politics and the corporate world and into the church and so forth. Right next to that access power of Germany and Italy, of the globalist socialists, the Marxists, not the Nazis, who ended up, the first ones ended up being worse overall, killed 100 million of their own people after World War II was over. Right next to that is France. And within 15 years, you had the fathers of postmodernism, like Foucault. And Derrida, deconstructionism, and Lyotard and Rorty and others. Well, you would think that these guys are going to be moral relativists, right? Their politics, then, since politics is ethics, they're going to be spanning the spectrum of extreme right and extreme left. But what we find, and I get into this in my book, is that every one of them, for the first and second generations, are hard new leftists. They're uber left. And what explains that? They were all members of the French Communist Party as well, or sympathizers with it. And what I meant to say about these incoherencies is that in Marxism, in critical theory, clearly they're dogmatists about certain things, right? You're either part of the oppressed or oppressor group, the haves and the have-nots, the victims and the victimizers. And then they have a story once you get the D, the diversity, and you identify all of these oppressor and oppressed groups along the axis of race, class, gender, ethnicity, and so forth. Then the next step is how you know about what's real, and that's what we call epistemology or theories of knowledge. And there, everything's based on your social location, your standpoint, called standpoint theory. It came out of second wave feminism, but Sandra Harding said she got it from Marx himself. And it's the idea that only those who are oppressed can have true knowledge about the oppression. They're not blinded. No uterus, no opinion, right? They're woke. And right. so what do you do about this then? That's where, if the ultimate problem is social oppression in group identities, the ultimate solution is social liberation or social justice, and it's reparations, revenge, payback, righting the wrong of this power imbalance in all of those various categories. So the Marxists, even the neo-Marxist, or the they're very dogmatic at times, and yet postmodernism is supposed to be having problems with dogmatism and meta-narratives and things like that. And so you're almost left to ask the question with this incoherency, and incoherencies do exist. I mean, the LGBTQ, you've got lesbians and then you've got trans. Well, that's the problem of answering the question, what is a woman? If you're going to be a lesbian, you got to be a woman. But if I can't answer that, those two groups incoherently exist together, but they are in alliance because they're trying to do something political in the culture. So you've got this incoherency existing in this second ideological revolution of postmodern cultural Marxism, but you're left to ask, which one is their real beliefs versus their superficial veneer that they're trying to impact the culture with? Is their real belief, are they Marxists? And their superficial aspect is postmodernism. They're trying to push skepticism on everybody so that no one knows. And then behind the paywall, they're pushing this dogmatism. Or is it the reverse? Are they pushing, you know, through guilt manipulation of the sentiments and this toxic empathy, we might call it? Are they trying to push that by talking about the underdog in all of these areas, black, woman, gay, trans or whatever? But ultimately, they're postmodernists, they're relativists. That's a good question in itself. But this, either way, this coalition, this postmodern cultural Marxist coalition, is now dominating in the universities. And this was the goal all along. And Gramsci spelled it out, talking about the long march through the institutions. But he realized, what the neo-Marxist realized, is that the West could never be infiltrated for revolution like the East could. And it's because they talked about the soft tissue of culture in the West called civil society. And unless you infiltrated and ensconced yourselves into the institutions like academia, media, and explicitly ecclesia, church, it'll never, the revolution will never happen. And so that's what the goal has been. And this is why now we see it. It's in our churches, it's in our seminaries, our Christian academic societies, and campus ministries. The barbarians are no longer at the gates. They're in the citadels. And so we're fighting this battle that's come from the universities also in the churches.
We certainly are. I've got a bunch of videos where I deal with progressive Christianity, and it is very much a lot of the same stuff. And if you pay attention, you'll realize that slow march, they're willing to do that as well. You know, you send your, you know, the congregation sends their pastor to a seminary. The seminary is a higher education facility, and they oftentimes they end up having a lot of these worldview problems going on at the higher levels. And so then the pastor comes back and his theology no longer matches his congregation. And so what he does is he has a long, slow march through his local church, trying to slowly integrate. And I mean, I'll be honest, this is what it looks like Andy Stanley's doing to me. It looks like Andy Stanley's doing exactly this. In fact, he's not even taking that long to do it, to be honest. But it's just, I'll introduce one idea. I won't tell anybody where I'm going. I'll just tell them the next step I want them to take. You know, with here's another teaching. Let's unhitch from the Old Testament. Let's say, I'll throw out in there, like, there's gay members in my congregation that have more faith in their hearts than the straight ones. And just leave it out. Just leave it hanging out there. Don't give any more explanation on it. Don't help people understand what you meant by that in our obvious situation in our society right now.
Yeah.
You know, those types of things. And so you've got pastors who are doing this in their congregations. So you go to the institution that has been compromised, and then you come out into your church, and probably within a couple generations, your church is 12 people, most likely. It's just going to shrink, because once you fully digest that sort of like progressive belief system, you're like, why am I even here?
Right.
I'm good.
Yeah. I'll just go hang out with my friends, because I'm not gaining anything of serious religious knowledge about God and how I ought to live based on what I know about God in the church, because pastors, mm-hmm. far too many pastors now, are caught up with whatever fad is there, like skinny jeans and fog machines, instead of doing what they should be doing, Ephesians 4:11-12, equipping the saints for works of service. And so you brought up, biblical worldview earlier. I think a lot of us are familiar with the worldview inventory that comes out annually from Arizona Christian University, where in 2022, I believe it was, they showed that only 6% of Americans hold to a biblical worldview. And just in case your listeners are wondering, you know, what would that mean? They were saying, one, belief in God's existence; two, humans are sinners in need of a savior; three, Jesus is the only way to salvation; four, the Bible is God's word, it's reliable in whatever it teaches; five, absolutes exist, grounded in God; six, the purpose of life is to know, love, and serve God; and then finally, maybe the most controversial, success is understood through faithful obedience to God. But it seems like you should have more than 6%. A year later, it dropped down to 4%. Among pastors, it's 37%. But I guess we have reason to celebrate, because when you say non-denominational and evangelical pastors, it's between 51 and 57%. Whoa, no wonder. And Mark Knoll wrote the book 30 years ago, The Scandal of the Evangelical Mind. And on page one, he said the scandal is that there isn't much of an evangelical mind. No wonder we're not equipping our people. And so these subtle philosophies come in and they're taking our people. And then because of either the ideology of feminism or just where we're at economically and politically, for some reason or other, and I'm not judging one or the other, both parents are now working and they're exhausted by the time they get home. And so we talk about, you know, train the child in the way they should go, and when they get older, they won't depart from it. Well, the parents have already conceded their education over to the public school system, or even the Christian school system, whose teachers are getting their college education from the secular universities. My daughter is an elementary ed major, and I look at the syllabus for every one of her classes at Purdue, one of the more conservative schools, and I can see this poisonous ideology in there. So you're not going to escape, even if you go to the Christian K-12s, and the parents are exhausted to teach the children. And so they go off to college with those statistics of professors. And mm-hmm. no wonder the apostasy rate is 50 to 80%. And so we are in a really super bad situation in the churches, with our families, at our homes. And then we go off to these secular baptismal fonts that even professors are now getting scared of because of the students and the climate that they created. It doesn't look good. But there is a way forward.
So we should talk about that. What is our way forward? Because let's say the reason to get into all this right here is not to say, and this is what I see constantly. Every time I put up a post online about changing things in the world in any way, shape, or form, there's somebody beneath it going, nothing's going to change. There's no point. Give up already. And then they're like, in their bio, they're like, living for Jesus. Okay, so I'm not here just wanting to put them on blast. I want to help them see that they actually have the power to make transformation and change in their own cultures.
Right.
And that it's very easy to just get used to just being aware of a bunch of problems and being frustrated about them and thinking it's inevitable. I spent a lot of years thinking that it was like in the larger culture of the US, the slide downward was an inevitable reality. And I have a completely opposite viewpoint now. And I think, I feel like I'm either Mary or Pippin, trying to talk to the Ents and trying to get them to go to war, going, hey, you're part of this world, you know, to tell this to the Christians, like, hey, let's mobilize and let's get out there and let's save people and let's save institutions. And they're not equal, but it's true that if you have freedom of speech, then you will have more salvations because the gospel can go out. It's true that if you have objective truth in our universities, then you will have more salvations because that is dependent upon the idea of objective truth. It's true that if you have Christian institutions that used to be Christian, that become Christian, if Harvard becomes a hotbed of Christian conservatism, which I think is possible, if that were to happen, and it might be 60 years from now, but if that were to happen, that would result in so many people not apostatizing their faith. That would result in future government leaders directing our country in positive. That would result in foreign leaders coming to get educated in American schools and leaving with a Christian worldview and impacting their countries for Christ. It's the potential for impact is so huge. So, Corey, please tell us about what are the on the ground things that need to happen, both short term and generational long term, for us to totally change everything.
The joke you used at the beginning, feeling like Pippin telling the Ents, "We have got to go to war."
Yeah.
It's interesting. I put ChatGPT to work on my book before I sent it off and asked it who my nemesis is, and it turned out to be Rod Dreher, that I call Rod Dreary. I like a lot of his books, but he is a defeatist. When he pursues dual citizenship in Hungary, sorry, we can't all run and escape, or we can't all go back to the 80s and build these almost like nuclear fallout bomb shelters so that we just go down and train our families and our cell groups in discipleship and just wait for society to collapse up on top. And once the fallout has finished its job, then we come back up and restart society. Rod Dreher says, the culture war is over, we lost. I say, no. And so I interview people like Al Mohler in the book to say, how did you take an institution at Southern Baptist Theological Seminary that was liberal and turn it? And I look at people like Alvin Plantinga in philosophy, one of the top philosophers of our time, who one atheist philosopher put out a word of warning to atheist philosophers. Watch out, everybody. Whereas God was dead in the academy in the past, in the 60s, he is no longer dead in philosophy departments. Approximately one third of philosophers writing at the highest level right now in the field of philosophy of religion are probably conservative evangelicals. He may be exaggerating, but that is a significant thing. That is a Normandy-like beachhead that has been established in what I would consider to be the most important academic discipline in the university, because behind every PhD is a doctorate of philosophy, even if they've never taken a philosophy class at all.
I love this so much. These are proof of concept things
proof
that
of
you're
concept,
talking about.
Absolutely. And,
yes,
and then the other,
this can really happen.
It can. And then the other proof of concept is what is actual entails what is possible. So when I lay this out in my book and I show how we started the universities and it lasted for, 250 years in America, something happened where the minority came in, crept in, and kicked out the majority and took over. And the new atheist reigned for about 20 years of that 100 years. And I look at someone like Richard Dawkins as like the Robespierre of the French Revolution, who created the guillotine, and then he got guillotined by his own guillotine, right? They got kicked out once, and then the second one is happening right now. The second time, so the poor Richard Dawkins is now saying, I'm sorry, could Christians come back, at least function as a bulwark against something worse, Islamicism over here or Marxism over here? They recognize this ideological revolution that's happening too. And people in the general culture can see it, given the fact that you have, recent presidential candidates that were Democrat that are now serving in the cabinet of the Republican Party, a Kennedy of all people. We are in a cultural revolution right now, and we've got to be thinking about what's at the top of the stream and how we change that. It's happened not once, but twice. We have examples of institutional recapture and disciplinary recapture. This can happen. And so in my book, the latter third of it, I lay it out and say that, look, where we're at in this cultural moment is that it's not so much that Christianity is just false. It's now looked at as hateful, oppressive, wicked, and so forth. We need to be able to show, one, that Christianity is good for the world, not just good for heaven, And that it is reasonable and that it's true. And that's where Ratio Christi and others like us in our industry specialize in that life of the mind, in giving reasons for why we believe what we believe. It turns out that we need to follow Jesus again, right? The Sadducees challenged him. He got one over on them, and the Pharisees came along and said, "What's the greatest commandment?" And he said, "Love God with all your heart, soul, and heart." No, he said, "Heart, soul, and mind." So if we want to be like Jesus and we want to follow Jesus, then we should stop excommunicating the mind like we've done in the last century as Christians, and love God with our heart and with our hands, but also our head, especially at the universities. And then in 1 Peter 3:15, it says, set apart Christ as Lord in your heart. That's the beginning. Be ready to give an answer for the reason, the head, for the hope, heart, and do it with gentleness and respect, the hands. It's high time that we resurrect the life of the mind and start following Jesus again. Christianity is good for the world. It's reasonable and it's true. And then I give a clarion call with some practical down-to-earth examples to pastors, to parents and grandparents, to professors and educators, to parachurches, political allies, donors and philanthropists, and prayers, all hands on deck. It's the university, stupid. You know, when we look at revivals or significant cultural movements in the past, they're almost always connected to the college campus, from Azusa to Yale to Asbury, and even to Dr. Professor Martin Luther's Wittenberg, always the college campus. And when, you know, James Davison Hunter wrote his book, he's a sociology professor, Christian, from the University of Virginia, to change the world. He said that the old model was changed lives, change cultures. He says, not so quick. Sometimes these get started by the grassroots, but until they get baptized by the institution or by the elite, you never gain traction for long-term cultural change. The Marxists recognized this, and that's why they talked about the long march through the institutions. We need to be doing this. Pastors need to start looking at, you know, scripture and theology and Christian thought more than culture and sociology to take their cues. Parents, even though both of them are working, maybe still, you need to train the child in the way they should go, or when they get older, they're going to get conscripted to work for the other side, and mm-hmm. you're going to be paying for their apostasy. Educators, professors, you need to realize that even like someone like my daughter, who's doing elementary ed, if she is not educated by someone like me or someone who can find the resources, right, to understand these deep philosophical nuances, she's going to be going into the K through 12 Christian schools and giving them this new philosophy. We have got to understand what is going on in our culture. And then our donors, stop funding those who hate you. Give to those whose worldview aligns with you. And at this point, I say political allies. I mean, I have partnered with Peter Boghossian. We've gone on lecture tour together. He's an atheist philosopher who wrote the book A Manual for Creating Atheists, because he was a scientific naturalist philosopher, and we both recognized there was something that was more nefarious than we viewed each other. And we believe in free speech together. We believe in truth together. We believe in defending the right to hear out the other. We need to find those whom we can agree with, because it takes 51% to get legislation passed. Even if we're not going to always agree together, Churchill and FDR had to partner mm-hmm. with Stalin. There are practical reasons. You got to be cautious, but be forthright.
Yeah, that's a whole different discussion too. I've been thinking about recently is this idea of you don't get a lot done if you're not willing to build a coalition with right. people you actually disagree with on major issues, because you know that together you can move the ball forward in a thing you do agree
right.
on. And then that matters, yeah.
I would love to just kind of talk about this briefly too, because when we're talking about solutions at the highest level, people are thinking, how do you do this? Well, first of all, you don't have to necessarily take, say, Harvard, Princeton, and Yale. The top 100 universities they're all called R1, or Research Level 1, high-level research, like Purdue, Texas A&M, and University of Central Florida. They have far, far more numbers of students, and that includes PhD students, than, say, Yale has. And so whereas the New York Times is still the paper of record, the USA Today has far more subscribers. So even if we feel like the walls are like the wall of China at Harvard, it doesn't matter. We can do the end run around it. And so what Ratio Christi is doing, for example, we're partnering with other organizations and we found some donors. One donor was an agnostic, by the way, a movie producer in Hollywood, sick of the wokeness there, and thought the best way to counter that long term is to fund Christian academics. So he gave me $100,000. And so we actually reach out and we fund top evangelical, broadly speaking, evangelistic PhD students that get into top 100 universities. And we are launching chapters that aren't for what we do in undergrad, which is apologetics evangelism, but instead it's about integration and infiltration. We are training them on how to start movements on these top 100 campuses where over 10 years they're going to be a factor of 100. They're going to be growing that large. And they will get jobs because they get first round draft choice in the job market. We walk with them for years. We are creating a fraternal movement of missional professors to do what the Marxists did. And that is to be salt and light, to hit a Normandy beach, and to take back France and Europe.
Amen. That is exactly what we need. I want to see the Christian professors working as hard at changing hearts and minds on ideological issues as all of my secular professors did when I was at university. First day in logic and critical thinking class, this is at Cerritos College, this one was at Cypress Community College. My professor asks everybody, go around the room and tell us something about yourself. And I'm like on fire, for the Lord. So I raise my hand. I was like, my name's Mike. I'm a Christian. I'm the only one who said this. Yeah. I knew it was not going to be a popular thing to say at the time. And he immediately highlighted on me and he was like, oh, you're a Christian. Well, let me ask you this. What chapter in the Bible is the Sermon on the Mount? Where is that exactly? He just wanted to make me look embarrassed, right? Like if I didn't know it. And I was like fortunate enough. I was like, I think it's like Matthew 5. And he was like, okay, well, let me ask you this. And then he riddles me about supposed contradictions in Genesis 1 and 2. This is first day of class because I said I was a Christian. You better believe nobody else there felt comfortable saying out loud that they were a Christian for the rest of the class.
Right.
And what we don't realize, like, this is, dude, my music history teacher was bashing on Martin Luther for no reason in the middle of a music history class. He defaced a church. He nailed the thesis. He defaced the church. And I was like, well, I thought that was like the bulletin board for the whole community. Everybody hammered stuff to the church door. And he was just like, whoa, and it was just all over. We need Christian professors who view it as part of their, in other words, we can't just be neutral. Like, we just want to move to neutrality. Like, that is not a solution. That just leaves the door open for the Trojan horse.
Right. And I think the majority of our professors, again, you're going through undergrad and then grad school and then your PhD, and you got to keep your head down. You got to get tenure. But still, even the ideological, philosophical aspects sometimes creep in and you don't even realize it. So that what I've found in the last 2 to 3 decades doing PhD and professor ministry is that most of our Christian professors are professors who happen to be Christians, not Christian professors, not missional professors. And what they're adopting is methods and ideas of a philosophy in their PH. They know their D, but they don't know the PH that they've sort of succumbed to along the way. So that's what we try to do, is we help them to understand the PH behind the D. We want them to integrate faith and reason, faith and life, faith and vocation. And then we want to take top professors who are in the field right now, who have been there for 30 years, and these guys are their mentors. Like, say, James Torr at Rice University. I was just with him last month, and he's one of the mentors. He's one of the top 10 chemists in the world, top 50 most influential scientists. So he's one of our mentors. We have others like William Lane Craig and still others that I could name that are mentors, to walk these people through, to help them to understand and then to navigate this hostile terrain going forward. And we see what happens to our kids when they go in there. On the other hand, just before this interview here, I just got a text from one of my former students that I taught at Indiana University. His first day of class, he came up to me as a professor in Intro to Philosophy. And he said, hey, Prof, I want to write a final paper on something that just demolishes Christians. I'm thinking about like the problem of evil and suffering. Can you tell me who to read and how to go forward? So I never told students where I was coming from until mid-semester, right? And that's when I sort of came out of the closet, so to speak, because I wanted to build credibility. And mm-hmm. I usually have this the signature statement that I give. And when I gave it, I say, hey, I want to let you guys know that I'm trying to teach you all how to be philosophers, and that every one of your professors down the hall has a PhD, and they all are armchair philosophers, even if they've never taken a philosophy class. And you have philosophical presuppositions, and so do I. And so I think it's only right that I finally disclose to you mine. I am an apprentice of Jesus, and I think that Christianity is intellectually superior to all competing worldviews. And then I pause and I look around. And the fruit that comes out of that, this guy's jaw drops. He comes up to me after we start talking. He ends up taking me for 4 classes. He becomes a Christian. And in this text I just got from him, he's asking me for advice and letter of recommends so that he can go to grad school and study Christian apologetics. He was a hostile atheist. Now he wants to go into ministry and go to grad school and make a difference. There is so much opportunity that Christians can have as professors if they'll stop being Christians who happen to be professors and become missional professors. But this is a long march because we are outnumbered severely, but we are not outgunned. And we need funding, we need networking, we need a coalition for this. It can happen, but we have to be very intentional about it, and it's going to be a long-term project.
And your guys' website is, correct me if I'm wrong, ratiochristi.org, is that right?
That's right, yep.
So it's ratiochristi.org. The only problem with having a foreign language as the name of your organization is that people are like, how do you spell that? But yeah, right. The idea here, though, is, you know, for people who want to get behind this financially, Ratio Christi has actually, they've got groups on campuses, and I've known about them for a while. I've had a bunch of your guys reach out to me in the past, either with questions or requests for interviews or maybe a visit. And I don't travel much. I should travel more in the future. We'll see if that works out. But they seem like, to me, the kind of people that I get excited about, because it's, I'll be honest, it's like an interest in knowledge, which you need for apologetics. You need to go for going deep into theology and into defending the Christian faith. But it seems to be coupled with people who are actually on mission, like not just hobbyist apologists who like to debate. There's always some people like that who just like to argue, but who actually forget about evangelism or what the purpose of it is. But I've just seen good things. The fruit that I've seen from Ratio Christi has been good. Your publications also are they're, they have like actually publish significant work on important topics relevant to the work you're talking about. The stuff that, so someone doing a dissertation or doing a PhD or something, they can actually pull from this like pool of work that you guys have published over the years that would aid them and stuff like that. It's all very exciting stuff.
Yeah, I think, you know, what separates us from typical apologetics ministries is that we're on the campus, the most influential institution shaping civilization. You know, our doctors, lawyers, K-12 educators, 1 out of 3 foreign leaders out of 180 countries, 1 in 3 prime ministers, dictators, whatever, got an academic degree from a U.S. university. So we're at that leverage point, that Archimedean point where we can leverage the world right there at the university. What separates us from the other campus ministries is that we do apologetics evangelism. But we don't want to be Mr. Spock. We don't want to be eggheads. That's how we were when we started about 15 years ago. We like to say, as the Stoic philosopher Epictetus said, we have 2 ears and 1 mouth for a reason, so that we listen more. If someone needs a hug, we give them a hug. But if they need an argument, we're the ministry on campus to give them an argument. And yes, you're right. Now we have a product line that we've reached out to some of the brightest minds in Christianity. And we have them writing booklets that are 25 pages, 11th grade reading level, on topics ranging from the problems of science and scripture and why does God allow evil, to everything now on race, class, sex, gender, ethnicity, and so forth. So if you don't want to read a 500-page book, like a lot of us who are more nerdy and like to, how about a 25-page book? And these are free for download on the PDF. If you just go on our website and put your email in and get our monthly, you know, propaganda newsletters, if you want them to fit on your phone, pay a nominal fee and you can get the EPUB versions or the printable versions. I know professors at Purdue who use some of these. I know, like my friend Sean McDowell at Biola uses these for his class, and I know high school ministries that use this for, you know, their youth group. So we want to be able to equip. We're a para-parachurch ministry. We've got a high school division. We've got 100 campuses for undergrad. We've got PhD student level, professor level, and then we're in about 15 countries around the world.
Okay, well, listen, here's something that excites me is, I'll just give you an example. What are some universities you're not on campus with, but you would like to be?
I mean, a lot of the New England Ivy Leagues would be fantastic. I will be lecturing at Princeton next month. We're on that campus, but we're not at Harvard or Columbia or Yale. But we are at all of those others that I was talking about, like Rice University and Texas A&M and Purdue and University of Central Florida. So, look, there are 4,000 colleges right. in the country. We're on about 100 of them. So
yeah, we need you on a lot more. So what I want to encourage is, so if here's the, what's the process? Like if someone wants to get you, is it enough for like a student to get together with a few people who says, let's start a Ratio Christi chapter? They go to your website, they reach out to you. How do we get started? Is that enough? Like, or is there, are there other obstacles that are more difficult to overcome?
Oh my gosh. I was just giving some lectures in New Orleans over this past weekend, and someone came up to me after my talk and said, we need to get one of your chapters at my university. Can you come and plant one there? And I said, your university, what do you do? Well, I'm a campus minister. And I said, oh, you already have a campus ministry. Yes, but we need a Ratio Christi. I've been reading your book and we need one. And I would be willing to start one. Wow. So we met for 15 minutes. I said, basically, you need probably two student officers. You're going to need a constitution, a club, a charter. Whoops.
Let's just ignore those balloons.
That's exciting.
I had something to do with the way you held your hand up or something.
Yeah. We're gonna need a constitution. Alliance Defending Freedom, our partner there, helps us writing every one of those, and then maybe a chapter director. He said, okay. He came back to me 4 hours later. He brought 60 students to this conference. He said, I've got four officers and 22 students signed up. Can we get started at the beginning of this semester? I mean,
right. That easy.
If you've got enough energy, you need basically two student officers. Find them in your mm-hmm. church, find them in your college ministry or something like that. Find them in another ministry because we get along with other ministries too. Find them and contact us and we will give you some training, try to get you started, give some accountability and so forth. And you probably can't see right now in my backdrop, but I like to tell people we are not just about books. We are about boots on the ground. So at the very top, I've got my combat boots.
Okay.
We want to get things done.
That is the bottom line with this video. This is my agenda too. I want to move Christians towards godly activism, interacting with our culture and bringing change. And that's when we spoke on the phone, this was kind of what we were chatting about as well. I remember a while back, but this issue is too important. So look, if you're at Harvard, if you're at, I think it was the three you mentioned that would be cool to start clubs at, which was Harvard. Where else was it?
So the top ones are usually Harvard, Princeton, Yale, Columbia, Stanford. We're at Princeton. We're not at any of those other schools, for example.
Okay. Harvard, Princeton, you said you're at Princeton. So though all those top Ivy League schools, if you're a student there or if you know a Christian student there, send them this video, ask them, hey, let's get something started. Because
absolutely.
This can be part of the transformation that 40 years from now, you look back and go, wow, what an amazing thing God has done in our country or in our communities, in our schools. This stuff, if you treat every one of these, even this tiny little club, like it's really important and it can change the world, then it just might. It just might. And so I encourage you guys, just go for it. Just don't be like, well, I'm not qualified enough. Doesn't matter. You being not qualified enough is better than nobody doing anything. So just go for it. You know, contact ratiochristi.org. And reach out and get your school started on these things. Get clubs started. Find out, hey, if you try it for 6 months and decide it was a bad idea, you could just quit. Okay. Just forward movement is what we need here as Christians. We need forward movement. What other things can Christians do? Like, for instance, let's say you've got legislation that they should be aware of.
Yes.
Or voting, things like that? Like, what other things can people who are not part of a university, they don't have kids that go, what can they do that would help change the country in these areas?
Right. So talking to your local legislator, for example, here in Indiana, we did something that, and I met with the senior legislator that passed the bill, that put forth the bill, and then it got signed into law by the governor. And we did something here that both Florida and Texas didn't do. They failed to do because they sort of overreached. We passed a viewpoint diversity law in Indiana. Now all of the public universities here, from Indiana University to Purdue and so forth, their professors are on notice that they have to be, for gaining and retaining tenure, they have to be minding their P's and Q's and be open to viewpoint diversity. You don't have to teach every single view on a topic. No one has time for that. But let's say someone, a student, calls the Capitol building down there and says, I've got this problem, this professor, this class. We're talking about critical race theory every day in class. Oh, well, what's the class? Math. Okay, that's a problem. And so that's one that gets looked into, right? Or for professors who feel like there's a chilled space in the air. They're the only Christian or conservative or even libertarian in their entire department. And they feel like they are getting inhibited from offering both sides, giving an education. They're supposed to toe the wheel for indoctrination because they still want to get tenure or whatever. In that case, they can call down as well because the law applies to, you know, students, faculty, staff on the university. So I write this out in the book so that anybody specifically in red states who want to go to their legislators, my book has been endorsed by legislators as well, if they want to go to their legislators and show the bill that Indiana has, they can do that there. DeSantis came up here to Indiana where he talked with our legislature. So some of these red state politicians, they talk to each other. And these local state legislators, I don't think we give enough credit to in terms of social change. We can have social change. We don't have to worry about the United States Congress or Senate. Let's start with our city councils, with our state legislatures and so forth. So I lay that out in the book. If churches, if campuses, if conferences want me to come and speak, I'm on speaking tour for the next 12 to 18 months about this. I'd love to do that as well.
You mentioned your book a few times. So for those interested, I'm holding it up now, The Progressive Miseducation of America, and by Corey Miller. And I think I put a link in the video description to where they can find it on Amazon, but obviously they could just Google it. It'd be easy to find it wherever. And the thing about activism, Christian activism for these kinds of things, is like helping people to feel empowered to the point where they're like, oh, here's like an actual step I could take, you know? What are other things like that? Like simple, straightforward steps. Like for instance, you guys could just write in your senators or whoever you can, even anybody in your government. You go on the government, congress.gov or whatever, and you find out who you can write to, and you click and you just say, hey, we need a viewpoint diversity bill in our state. And you just put that out there, and then they tally these numbers, and it does actually make a difference because hardly anybody reaches out to these guys. So when you do,
right,
it does get noticed, right? Because most Americans are just completely checked out. We just show up and vote, and we sort of vote by our gut, or we vote by like what we happen to catch. I talked to a fellow American, I'll say, who was saying, I try to get both sides of the story, and I really want to make sure I'm well informed. And I was like, so how do you do that? And they were like, well, I watch PBS. And I was like, oh, so you just watch like a total left leaning, you know, news propaganda type thing, basically. Yeah. And so we're not that well informed, but we're also not very involved. We just vote, and then we're quiet for the rest of the time. So right into them. Let me ask you a question, Corey. What do you think California needs? I'm here in California. Okay. I live in LA County.
Wow.
What is our like path forward for changing things when it comes to education in the state of California?
The title of my book, before the publisher changed it on me, was The Third Revolution, From the Campus to the Culture and a Vision Forward. And so I'm calling for a third revolution, and now people understand what I mean when I've talked about two ideological revolutions that have happened in the university. But the kind of revolution, the third revolution in the university I'm talking about, doesn't need to just happen in the universities now. It needs to happen in our church subculture as well. We're talking about a Jesus-like revolution. We're talking about one that begins with ideas, right? Jesus says the purpose to life is to know God, John 17:3. We need our churches, our youth groups, to be thinking about this stuff too. And so I would say that, parents listening right now would have vested interest talking to their youth pastor about starting a Ratio Christi College prep club in their church to prepare them not just to survive, but to thrive when they go off to the secular university, or the education pastor, or the senior pastor, or whatever, so they can understand what this false ideology is, or these poisonous ideologies coming down and going into the churches. We've provided the equipping material so that they can easily just do reading discussion groups, or they can learn about a topic themselves. But the revivals have to start in the church. The revival doesn't start with the secular world. It doesn't start with Gavin Newsom. Right? The revival starts with the Christian community. And so while we're busy as a calling, Ratio Christi, trying to go off to the universities and defend our own and advance the cause of Christ there, the majority aren't doing that. But as a prior military person, I remember learning in the Army that for every one combatant on the field, there were 10 people in support for that combat troop. Either join us on the campuses or support what we're doing financially, or take advantage of our resources and start a filled chapter, not at the university, but in your church, that's Ratio Christi College Prep, that's preparing them for college. And I say this when I'm at seminaries recruiting too. I say, look, you can go and still be a full-time pastor. That's fine. You could also be on staff with Ratio Christi part-time and consider this a church growth model. Instead of just having a food pantry or something like that for outreach, everybody's got a college, a community college, a university within striking distance. Why not start a Ratio Christi chapter there with us at the university, or take your students and go over there and do evangelism with them? Because we don't focus like standard campus ministries on Bible studies, prayer groups, and Thursday night barn dances, or people can't dance anyway. But we instead encourage new or nominal believers to go to the churches, go to the local churches. So if you're a pastor listening to this, a youth pastor, an educator, an elder, or whatever, think about this as church growth. Go launch a chapter, and then any new or nominal believers, where do they go? Your church. And so it's a win-win-win situation. You're helping us to take back the universities, you're preparing your people for what's coming, and you're growing your church at the same time.
That sounds good to me. And you guys have these resources for people to do this, and they can find it all on the website?
Yeah. Go to ratiochristi.org. You can find all of our divisions. You can find our press, our booklets. You can find out what campuses we're on. And if you want to join the movement, Uncle Sam needs you. So join.
Right on. Okay, here, I got a question for you. I wasn't sure if I should ask this or not, but I'm going to throw it out there. You can tell me if you think it's a good question to answer or not. I was hoping you would give me a list of best and worst universities when it comes to the Christian worldview analysis.
Oh boy. I mean, when we're talking about worst, if I can just start at
Christians,
including Christian ones. Well, if I can start at the top with Harvard. So Harvard, you know, its motto used to be truth for Christ in the church, and it lasted for about 300 years until 1936. I've been on all the colonial school campuses. I've seen the etchings in the walls. I know what their mottos are, even though they've scrubbed it on their websites. But Harvard now has their lead chaplain is an atheist, and they just last month hired a new professor whose name is, get this, Lahore Vaginistan. He's from Lahore, Pakistan, but he puts a W before the whore part. Lahore, vagina, Vaginistan.
So this is a fake name he uses because he's perverted, basically.
Yeah, he's talking, you know, queer everything. We move down the road to Yale, who was the second university, and their motto is Lux et Veritas, light and truth, because of the Hebrew focus on light, God's presence, God's salvation, God's favor. And Harvard started to drift, and so Yale began anew. And they have, I've just got the book right here, Queer Theology by Lynn Tonstad in the Yale Divinity School. She's got a mohawk, is a lesbian, and she says to her students, it's based on a semester class she teaches, that we're not going to be studying much theology in here. We're going to be studying queer theory, queer critical theory. We're going to be talking about queering God and queering Christianity. That's Yale Divinity School that graduated Jonathan Edwards, who then went down the street because Yale started to drift and became the president of Princeton Theological Seminary. And at Princeton, of course, we have Peter Singer, who is the most infamous or famous professor alive today. I'm going to try to connect with him next month. I dialogued with him in the past, but he wrote the book, The Unsanctifying of Human Life. That is, since we now know that God doesn't exist, there's no such thing as the sanctifier of human life, so there's no such thing as the sanctity of human life. And so he believes that you can kill not just preborn, but also postborn. And look now in our culture, we live in an infanticide community with half of our country embracing it, half of our politicians. But mm-hmm. also we live in, you know, what the New York Post described was a culture of assassination now, right? Where when Luigi Mangione shot and executed that CEO, Brian Thompson from United Healthcare, those who were 45 and under, ages 45 and under, 31% of them sided with the assassin, not the assassinated. Why mm-hmm. do I bring that up at 45 and under? Because the closer you get to the epicenter, the university, that is the impact they're having on people. And mm-hmm. so you say, oh, well, I should avoid Harvard, Princeton, and Yale then. I should instead go to Calvin, Wheaton, or Biola. I guarantee you, and I can give you plenty of examples, that those schools have been infiltrated. Calvin is gone, in my view. Wheaton is going. And Biola, we will know this decade. There is an internal fight. But if parents say, well, give me the list of schools where none of this stuff exists, I say all two of them, right? I mean, even when I was lecturing on Grove City College's campus in Arabic philosophy last year, I was having a conversation with some of the faculty who were saying, hey, things have gotten better here, but we notice you're on the list to get rid of our president. And I said, yeah, we can't lose another institution. Well, things have gotten better. And I pulled up my phone and I said, here is a professor in psychology. Look at his Facebook profile still says, stay woke. This stuff is everywhere. Parents need mm-hmm. to do their homework. If you mm-hmm. want to contact us, I can give you links to websites that will help you analyze the Christian schools and what's going on there as well. So
right.
I don't want to discourage people and say, well, we just should put our head in the sand and not go to college at all. Because college is where it's pumping out all of the leaders, including the world leaders. You need to simply be equipped, whether you're going to a Christian school or not. I would almost rather send someone to Harvard because at least we know what we're going to get than some of these Christian schools where we think we're going to get a Christian education. And so we don't put up our antennas to try to understand their philosophical presuppositions that are coming out of that Christian school.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Now, with the Christian schools, we have a type of leverage, which is that a lot of the donors, the big donors who are supporting Christian schools, think that those schools are still holding fast to conservative values, conservative theological Christian positions. And if they simply leverage their influence and say, you better do what I think you're doing because I'm supplying you with a significant amount of money, then they can bring some real change, I think. I think really quickly, too. I think very quickly they could do that because yeah. I've learned this year, that the number one issue for these Christian schools is simply fundraising. That is the number one issue that drives the school and yeah. ends up affecting policy and ends up affecting everything else. And this is why with the recent stuff about Biola, for those who don't know, public questioning of some of the problems that are going on at Biola, not to throw the whole school under the bus, but right. there's been public questioning about it. And that has caused the needle to move to some degree. I say to some degree, because if you have people in the institution who are at the highest level and they're serious about getting rid of bad ideologies, they can do it. They can make that happen if they want to.
Right.
Like they're being drugged that direction. But you know what? That's still the right direction. If we have to drag you through your donors the right direction, then I don't have a problem with that
Let's do it.
personally.
Yes. Yeah, for example, when I go out there and I examine mission drift at these Christian colleges or ministries or whatever, from Veritas to Campus Crusade to Azusa Pacific to Biola, I notice a pattern, and that is typically their boards won't have anybody that I say is a sniffer in the right field. That is, they may have some PhD board members, but they're in engineering or something else, business or whatever. They don't have a sniffer. That is a PhD in philosophy, biblical studies, or theology that can sniff out these ideas, right? Usually presidents have to raise money. I get it. I'm a president. I need to raise money. And so the temptation is you go sell board seats to rich guys, and no one is there to sniff things out, and no one's there to keep the president accountable either. This is how we lost Princeton, Harvard, Yale, and it's how we're starting to lose these other schools. And so I can say, with all those institutions I just mentioned, it's true on those accounts. I used to be Campus Crusade. I've engaged with Veritas at the highest level. I'm friends with people in CRU at the highest level. I have great friends at Biola. I did a master's degree at Biola. We have a partnership with Biola. But I think Barry Corey, the president, needs to be challenged. And you can look at the money coming into Biola and start to trace it and find that there's been a shift of grassroots dollars to big dollars. And they have, one of their board members has family background that was guilty of campaign finance stuff and was sending money to the Clinton foundations. And that's on their board. I've known other board members who have been on their board, and they've told me what was going on in there. And I've listened to some of the talks some of their board members have given. And so they've got some woke stuff going on at the board level. The president has been under tremendous pressure lately, but it's because there has been a lot of newsworthy articles about one professor practicing divination recently. So they just finally released that professor. They have, their sexuality statement just got changed. Oh, wasn't that convenient, right? So this stuff is still happening after the last 5 years. They had an entire DEI or DIE department. No Christian school, once you understand what the DIE is from its Marxist roots, no school, the wages of sin is death to any institution that brings that on. What in the world is a Christian institute having a diversity, inclusivity, equity department, not just one person, but an entire department? So yes, I think the donors need to be putting pressure on the presidents of schools. We cannot, my heart is for Biola. We cannot lose Biola. I've got great friends there that are stalwart and that are absolutely on our side. They're insiders. Outsiders like me, like you, like other people, we can speak more candidly than those who are faculty who are getting their paycheck from there as well. We're doing it for the good of Biola, not just because we're trying to gossip or anything like that. We can't keep losing these institutions. What are we going to do? Go start a brand new one and have an endowment of $10,000 and an Atari computer, whereas Harvard has $52 billion, more than over 50% of the GDP for the countries that exist out there? We cannot keep doing that. We have got to watch and guard like a hawk mission drift and challenge the leadership when they're not doing it. And then we have to practice this long march through the institutions and infiltration back into academia now.
So I have an idea for you. Tell me what you think of this. Maybe this is a wouldn't work, or I'm missing something. But you're saying that a lot of these boards, they don't have like a sniffer, someone who goes, "Dude, that is anti-Christian ideology that your
Right.
school is now adopting." What if you guys, Ratio Christi, started doing that on behalf of donors and simply said, "Hey, donors, here's what we stand for. If this is what you stand for, we can be the people who help assess that your donations are being used well in the schools that you're supporting." I mean, that could be huge leverage potentially for donors to go, because I don't have the time. I'm running this business. I'm doing this stuff, and I don't really
Right.
know all those things. But if I know what, because here's the thing, Ratio Christi, like what you guys stand for is out in the open. Progressives is always under the table, and this is the whole long, slow march thing. Is it's a lot of just slowly pushing your agenda and not telling people. But if you were able to get involved to agree and go, I represent this group of donors who are supporting, say, Biola or somewhere else, and they want to know what's going on in the sociology department. So I'd like to interview a couple of your professors and then give feedback to those donors. I feel like that could make a big difference. What do you think?
My reluctance in doing that is I'm happy to do it from like right here in my writings and things like that. But because I've already got a day job and a night job, it would be mission drift, and I cannot lead the ship of where Ratio Christi is going, because then I would have to turn about face and focus now on the Christian institutions.
I don't mean you personally doing it. I actually mean Ratio Christi doing it, because you have a reputation and people know what you guys stand for, and you guys are already active in the universities.
Yeah.
So if you guys then brought in, you know, some people who you could access, maybe you hire somebody who then just starts networking with donors. Hey, if you guys are interested, we don't need your money, but we would love to help you make sure that your money's being used for the Christian worldview.
Look, if there's a donor listening right now and they thought it an interesting investment for us to hire a person like that to focus intently, we would be happy to be the sheriff in that sense, because I have no doubt that we are per capita the most educated campus ministry, and our board is stacked with people so that we're not going to mission drift. And we've got networks with a lot of these other, we're partners with a lot of these seminaries and other campus ministries, even though we know some of the things that are happening. So, you know, we know resources and other people who are focused on this stuff too. But if donors wanted to support us and encourage us to put a little bit more light on that, I'd be happy to partner or hire a staff person that focuses intently on that as well. So anyone listening, contact us.
The sniffer position.
The sniffer position. And I will say that even with some of these ones that might have one sniffer, I guarantee you I'm in contact with that sniffer or those sniffers, and I'm trying my hardest for the time bandwidth that I have to help them to see some of this stuff. But a man convinced against his will is of the same opinion still. And there are complicated issues behind the scenes, and people are motivated by different things as well. Right. And at the end of the day, people are going to follow what path they're going to follow.
Okay. Well, I have no idea what you're referring to with stealthily there, but I'm sure
without naming some of the individuals because I'm having personal conversations with them.
Fair. I think that what I just wanted to encourage for anybody who's doing the work you're doing and listening in on it is, if we think about, like, we list the problems and the colleges, and it's easy to be like, so we should definitely not send our kids to Biola, or we should definitely not send our kids to Harvard. And you cautioned against this. You're like, well, the down the road result of that is that you guys are monks living off on your own monastery. Basically, you're not going to be in the influence positions in the future. You're not going to have generations of leaders. Right. You'll have generations of people who work for leaders, and they'll be complaining, but they won't have an impact. And so if we are going to talk about taking back secular institutions, we also have to have an optimistic attitude about taking back Christian ones, or keeping them from sliding away. And to gather, now I'm not rich, okay, but for those who are like truly genuinely very rich, to gather their strength together, but also have that accountability there where they're going, we want to reward the institutions that are going to do the right thing with the Christian worldview and with Christian students. That is such a great incentive for schools, because now they're not just afraid of being exposed by you know, or by me or whoever, right?
Right.
They're actually empowered to be on mission for what they were originally founded to do. And that's a powerful thing, but with consequences. And if you drift off mission, you're going to lose this whole chunk of support. And I'm hoping that happens. But anyways, all right. So Dr. Corey Miller, I'm grateful for you, man, and for the work you guys are doing. And people can follow up, go to, you know, ratiochristi.org, or they can check out your book, The Progressive Miseducation of America. And I don't do too many interviews. I will try to do more in the future here, but I want Christians to feel optimistic. Yes, it's dark. Yes, it's dark. But
good reason to be optimistic. And they could also go to drcoreymiller.com as well. And there they can see my speaking schedule, invite me to speak, read the introduction or first chapter for free of the book. and jump into the Ratio Christi website that way as well. So number of different ways to access us, but we want to be team players. I say go team, go God. We're on mission together. We need coalition. We need each other. We're facing a lot in America.
Yes, we are. And we are so incredibly powerful if we just believe that we can make a difference. There's so many believers who, even the somewhat nominal Christians, if they just get serious for 5 seconds, then we're all going to be on the same page. And we can influence so, so much. So no more defeatism. Let's try and change the world. And if we die trying, that was totally worth it.
Yeah, that's right.